Hi, everyone, and welcome to Oscar Wilde, a podcast about film, always counting down to next year's Oscars. I'm Sophia Simonello.
And I'm Mick Werkraut.
And we are back with a brand new season. Welcome to season 6 of Oscar Wilde. It's crazy that we're on season 6. We had a nice break after the Oscars, I think, just taking some time off like we do every year. But we are back. We're re-energized and ready for a new season. And to do that, today we are celebrating the 25th anniversary of Cameron Crowe's Almost Famous.
Yeah, I'm happy to be back. I love that we have a ton of new topics coming and series. So we have a lot planned for season 6. It's, yeah, kind of crazy we've made it this far. And I think this was a great choice to start off our season 6. We usually go back 50 years or more to some of the classics from Oscar's history, big Best Picture winners. And this didn't necessarily win Best Picture. That's maybe part of our conversation, but it did win an Oscar. It ran through award season, and this is a new favorite watch of mine. So I'm excited to dive in to this one today.
Well, I'm so excited that it's a new favorite watch of yours. And I think part of the reason why I felt this would be a good idea for our season premiere and just an anniversary episode is exactly like you said, we usually go a bit further back in time, but I think a lot of our listeners probably have a personal relationship to this movie just based on when it came out. And I think it just, as a coming of age story and as a film about music and loving art, I think that naturally a lot of people who love films and who happen to like award season too, this is just a really special movie. So I'm excited to talk about it today.
Yeah, so what is your relationship with this movie? Like I said, this is a new one for me. I just watched this in January, so a lot of this is now a rewatch, but very new to me. And being about the 70s, and I would say some of your favorite music, when did you first see this, and how did you connect with it?
I saw it, I think, at the perfect age. I was our protagonist, William Miller's age, or around his age. I was a teenager, like early teens, I would say. And I think it was important for me watching it at that time because I think that that's also the time in your life when you form your music taste. That's when art really just makes a mark on you. I think you start feeling out what kind of music you like. And for me, my two art forms that I really loved, I think especially at that age, and I still love today, are music and movies, music and film. And at this time, I was getting really into things like, you know, indie pop and alternative music, which was great when we were teenagers. But also, I think, you know, my parents are big music people and introduced me to a lot of new wave bands, and I grew up with those bands, but also classic rock bands like The Who, like Pink Floyd, Led Zeppelin, a lot of the bands that are referenced in this movie. So this movie, I think, came at the right time for me, and I've really loved it ever since. But I love that it was a new watch for you. So what did it feel like watching it today? Was it kind of one of those movies where you thought, where have you been all my life?
Kind of. I was just blown away by all of it, the filmmaking, the acting, the vibes. It just captures such a specific mood of the 70s and of music and art, like you're talking about. It's somehow so bright yet nostalgic at the same time. And I think from William's perspective as a kid, really growing up, he was robbed of his adolescence, like his sister said, and we see him grow through these different bands and Philip Seymour Hoffman as his mentor. And it just gives you such an interesting look into the music industry and some of these famous, since this is somewhat autobiographical, bands and artists of the time. I also really loved Kate Hudson and Frances McDormand. I mean, everything from the intro, I think this is like a perfect first act of a movie. I just love meeting all of them and seeing them in San Diego. And then the entire journey. It feels like we really have come so far by the end of this movie and just understand all of the ups and downs of the time, the era, and these people. They feel so real. So there's a lot that Crow did very well here, and it's definitely my favorite of his movies.
I'm so happy to hear that. It's definitely my favorite of his movies too, and I can't wait to talk about just the scenes and the quotes and what we think of the soundtrack, maybe most importantly. But we're getting ahead of ourselves as usual. Description here. In 1973, 15-year-old William Miller's unabashed love of music and aspiration to become a rock journalist lands him an assignment from Rolling Stone magazine to interview and tour with the up-and-coming band Stillwater. This was written and directed by Cameron Crowe and stars Kate Hudson, Billy Crudup, Frances McDormand, Philip Seymour Hoffman, Patrick Fugit, Zooey Deschanel, and more. This premiered at the Toronto International Film Festival, or TIFF, in 2000, and was followed by a release on September 22nd of that same year. And just getting into award season and the Oscars a bit before we talk about a review of the movie, we'll come back to the Oscars, of course, but at the Golden Globes, this won Best Film, Comedy, or Musical, and Supporting Actress for Kate Hudson. It was also nominated for Original Screenplay and Supporting Actress for Frances McDormand. Quick note on this, this is one of the earliest awards I remember, because even though I was only, seven at the time, I remember being so happy that Kate Hudson won, and I hadn't even seen this movie. I just remembered the poster and just thinking it was cool that she won, but that is one of my earliest awards memories. Then at the BAFTAs, this won Best Original Screenplay and Best Sound, and was also nominated for Best Film, Best Film Music, Supporting Actress for McDormand, and Best Actress for Kate Hudson. So they put her in lead. And then at the Oscars, this was the year that Gladiator won Best Picture, so maybe we can talk about what we would have voted for there. And Almost Famous won Best Original Screenplay. It was also nominated for Editing, and Frances McDormand and Kate Hudson were both nominated for Supporting Actress. This was the year of one of the wildest supporting actress races, where Marsha Gay Harden won for Pollock. It was a big surprise. We can again talk about who we would have voted for there. But yeah, so this is one of our, I think, great original screenplay winners too, so we can talk about the screenplay. But maybe we just dig into some of our favorite scenes. What are some of your favorite scenes? I mean, definitely the opening for sure. Just when you meet young little William Miller and he finds out he's not 13 like he thinks.
From the very beginning, from the title sequence of him writing all of the names down and how he misspells Frances of Frances McDormand. Him writing things down, becoming a journalist, how important that is to his career, is just a smart, easy way to start off this movie, letting us see his handwriting and see his style. And then we get into San Diego, it's Christmas, and how neurotic his mom is. She goes, "Excuse me, sir, Xmas is not a word," which is also a motto of mine. And he's like, "Okay, ma'am, thank you. I don't care." But we meet the family, the sister, Zooey Deschanel, and how she loves music. The mom won't let them listen to anything. And when she leaves, she gifts him her vinyl. And it's just such a sweet moment that you know has such an effect on him. So I think the intro, and yes, at this point, we're still with the young William, and he's 13, no, he's 12, no, he's 11, because she skipped him two grades, which I think is great that she's a teacher and she's like, "I taught him kindergarten at home when he was four." It just feels like home. It's maybe, you know, not this perfect home, but there's something to connect to between all of these relationships already. And this is very early. So I think in terms of the screenplay standpoint, it's so smart. And we haven't even gotten into the musicality of the movie. Like I said, the radio show with Philip Seymour Hoffman yet. There's a lot of world building that I think is done very well here.
I agree. When I watched the beginning of the movie, now I wonder if Greta Gerwig was inspired by it at all with Lady Bird. They may have different settings, but that idea that you're talking about of just feeling like you know this family, it feels like home, it's so specific to them. I love that, and I feel like Cameron Crowe does such a good job with it, and Frances McDormand as Elaine Miller, his mother, is just perfect. I love her in this film, and you get to know her right away as this very, you know, eccentric college professor who has her own ideals and ideas for sure of how to raise children. I love the line she has later in the film when she's like, I'm a college professor and I can't teach my own kids. That's so good. But what's cool about her relationship with her son, even though, of course, both of her kids end up leaving home in their own ways really early, is that she's so excited for him when they're talking about literature early on, and he is talking about Boo Radley and To Kill a Mockingbird. But this is just really, I think, starting his appreciation of art and literature and writing that he'll just continue in a different way. And I agree. I love that when his sister Anita leaves and she says, one day you'll be cool. Look under your bed. It'll set you free. And he finds all of those vinyls. And that is, I think, when you're that age, what it feels like to have someone hand you art that is theirs and to tell you, you'll love this. This is going to make you feel a certain type of way. It's going to set you free. I love when she has the note with Tommy, the Who record, and instructs him to play it with a candle lit so he can see his future. And that, I think, is just such a smart moment of editing, too, and just conjuring up a feeling, because when he's listening to Tommy, that's when we get the time jump and we move forward and he's older now and he's just fully engrossed in the rock world. He wants to be a music journalist, and we meet the great Philip Seymour Hoffman as Lester Bangs, who, great character name, and another wonderful Philip Seymour Hoffman performance, even though he had the flu the entire time they were shooting.
Yeah, I love how the beginning of the film, again, is really about how the women have shaped his life. So his mom and his sister are really the only characters we meet at this point. And then when he's older, because his dad's not in the picture, we meet Lester. He's really the first one, or the one that sticks around for the entirety of the film. William comes back to him when he's having trouble getting the interview with the band, with Stillwater. And then we meet the band and how chaotic they are. And eventually we meet Penny Lane, the remarkable Kate Hudson here, I would say, at a very young age. But she's the next woman in his life, and he falls in love with her, or he's grappling with his feelings for her. So I like how we have sort of an arc through the film, and the ending is very different, so we'll get there in a bit. But how each of them affects him differently, and what they each are teaching him on his road to growing up, even though he's, again, younger. He doesn't even tell them their age. And I love how Russell finds out about it through the phone call from the mother later in the film. And then when he walks into the Rolling Stones office and they're all just like trying not to snicker at him because he's so young. So I think it's interesting how they play with age too, and these rock bands that are young, and all of the comments from the mom that Elaine chimes in throughout the film.
On the age point too, I really like when he meets Penny Lane and he says, I'm 17. Me too. No, I'm actually 16. Me too. And the, like, they're, no one is ever really being truthful. Like, even as she responds, she's lying about her age. She's also not telling him her real name. She's like, I'll never tell. When he asks, she's kind of also creating this persona. And I feel like she's such a great character. Even from the first moment that we meet her, and he, you know, sees this group of girls that she's with, and he starts to call them groupies. And they're so taken aback by that and say, no, we are not groupies. We're Band-Aids. Penny Lane is the one who changed everything. We love the music. We're not just here to sleep with rock stars. It's a different thing altogether, which makes me think of School of Rock and when Summer doesn't want to be called a groupie.
Oh my God, yes.
But I think his introduction to that world, he's really just thrown into it, right? He's on assignment to cover Black Sabbath, but then his in there is that he calls all of the members of Stillwater by their names. And what's interesting is that what Lester tells him at the very beginning is, you can't be friends with rock stars. Like, you're a critic. You need to separate the two. You cannot be their friend. And he basically, in that first moment, spells out the entire thing for him. Everything that's going to happen to him. He's like, they're going to buy you drinks. You're going to meet girls. They're going to fly you places for free. It sounds great, but they're not your friends. And he tells him that at the very beginning. And he's a smart kid, but he falls for it anyway. And you get to see, I think, you know, not that they're deceiving him necessarily, but just how easy it is to get sucked in when you love something that much. Mm-hmm. And you just want your opportunity to do your job. Yes, like, he really wants to be a rock critic, but also he loves music first in the same way that Penny Lane does. So I like seeing them kind of as these distinctive, different characters that are also kind of on these parallel journeys of loving something so deeply that is art itself, but also having their heart broken by people also in the center of that.
Yeah, the phone calls with Lester I like, because you can see that William is failing to listen to his advice.
Mm-hmm.
But he's still being somewhat sympathetic and helping him through. And I feel like that could be an easy plot point in just a movie standpoint that would become distracting or frustrating. And I think they handle that well here. In terms of the scene you're talking about at his first gig, I also love this scene. Seeing Penny Lane for the first time at the top of the ramp with all the girls. Also, the Band-Aids is just a great name for a group. And I love that he calls the group Stillwater incendiary. And that's really what grabs hold of him for them. And he gets them in. And from there, it's just this, whirlwind of a journey. They go to so many different cities. They go to Cleveland. That is this rock capital at one point.
Did you love when they make the comment about Cleveland and one of the characters says something about it being like the all-time greatest hotel? It's like, what is this?
It shocked me.
I mean, Cleveland is the capital of rock music. Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is there. But I loved that. Anytime we get to go to Ohio.
And New York here. We're in New York at one point, and I love seeing them in the city. Do you have any favorite locations or moments of them on stage? I know we can talk about the soundtrack here, because a lot of medleys are played in montages kind of as we come along. There's a lot of Elton John that I love, and Tiny Dancer that comes back in at the end that they sing together on the bus. That's one of my favorites. But do you have any favorite songs or other scenes?
Oh my gosh, there's so many that are tied directly to music, but I would say my favorite locations, I think, really are when they're on the bus or they're traveling together. That feels so of the time too. It's so funny, when I was watching it, I just thought, you know, the tour bus feels like such a relic. That kind of bus, as it said, you know, Stillwater Tour 1973. It just feels like such a classic from that time. And it's a good way, I think, to get to know the band, is when you're seeing them all together on that bus. Tiny Dancer is really, I think, the standout musical scene for me. It just makes me smile and it makes me tear up every single time. I think it's just that feeling of when a great song comes on the radio when you're on a road trip. But it also reminds you that these characters all love music, not just their own, and feel inspired by that too. I love how they just each start to sing and then they're all singing together.
Mm-hmm.
My favorite Elton John song is Mona Lisa's and Mad Hatter's, which is also in the movie. I love that needle drop. It's pretty remarkable that they got so many Led Zeppelin songs too, and have so many Zeppelin references, because Led Zeppelin songs are notoriously challenging to get. They're very expensive, but Cameron Crowe screened the movie in London for Jimmy Page and Robert Plant, and they agreed to let him use 4 songs in the movie. And Tangerine is one of my favorite Zeppelin songs, and that's at the very end, and I think it's just gorgeous. The line, "I was her love, she was my queen," just feels so fitting for the movie and how it ends and the relationship to Penny Lane. And then I think my other big standout scene connected to the stage is when we see Penny Lane dancing to The Wind by Cat Stevens in that abandoned auditorium. And I love just how she's dancing to that song, and it's only maybe a minute long, or maybe a little over a minute, and there's just confetti and trash strewn everywhere, but it just looks so beautiful. Mm-hmm. And it's just such another, you know, a great moment of Kate Hudson's performance. So I would say that one for sure.
Those were all of mine. I have both Elton John songs written down. I have The Wind by Cat mm-hmm. Stevens. I think that is beautiful, and how just the music fits into these moments of the film and what it represents for these people, with William looking at Penny so longingly at many of these moments and trying to figure her out. I think that's one of the big mysteries of the film, because she carries herself with such an aura, but so mysteriously. She, like we talked about, her age, we don't know. They have this trip to Morocco planned that never comes about, and we don't really know what it is anyway, or what mm-hmm. it signifies for them. I mean, it's this hope for the future, this unknown point in time where everything is happy and they're together. And even though it doesn't materialize, again, it tells us about them and what they mean to each other. And somehow they're getting through this by not saying the truth, like you mentioned earlier. And I like that you play along. You have to figure out things along with this movie.
Yeah. And another thing I think in thinking about Kate Hudson's performance that I love so much is that we really see this clear distinction in how she views her relationship with a character like William and a character like Russell. And it reminded me a lot of how I feel watching Paul Thomas Anderson movies, specifically Licorice Pizza, which is set at the same time. I think those films are trying to do different things, but it's interesting when you see the way that a young woman might react to two different men at different points in their lives. And I think with her relationship with William, she knows that he likes her and that he values her and everything, but she sees him almost as this comfort, right? Like it's a different type of relationship to her. And she's almost guiding him along at the same time. But then there's that moment, too, when the Band-Aid, played by Anna Paquin, tells him, you were her excuse to come here to see him, because she and Russell have this relationship together. And when I was a teenager watching this, I didn't quite understand, I think, all of the little subtleties between Kate Hudson and Billy Crudup's performances in playing Russell and Penny, because when you watch it now as an adult, you see all of their history on screen from the first moment that we meet them. You know mm-hmm. that something's been going on between the two of them, and there's a lot of history there, and it's been there for years. And I think what Kate Hudson does so well is really in every minute that they are in the same room together, she is completely aware of where he is, of how she is performing at the same time, right? Because she isn't on stage in the way that the band is, but I think that she is also actively playing a character. Penny Lane is a version of herself, and she, importantly, I think at one point when she's talking to him about that Morocco trip, she says, we can be totally different people. So you never really know the real her, right, and who she is, but I think Kate Hudson does such a good job of creating a character that, you know, is an enigma, but also that you feel like you really know at the same time, which is exactly, I think, what our characters in the film feel about her.
She somehow acts with her heart on her sleeve. But again, there's a lot that we don't get to find out because of that. And looking at William and Russell, you see that William is the comfort and Russell is this way more emotionally volatile and rambunctious character. And it's really like two sides of a coin. She wants it all, and she either doesn't want to decide, or she loves living in the world that she's created for herself. So I think, yeah, just trying to figure out who she is and seeing her highs and lows. I love her scenes when she's crying or ends up crying. The first time, or maybe my favorite time, is at the diner later when William tells the band that they'll be on the cover of Rolling Stone. And Russell's wife that we just met and found out that he had a wife minutes ago is there as well. And she keeps looking at Penny over in the corner. And then Penny's eyes just well up and they're so red. And these tears just stream so easily down her face. And she looks so beautifully heartbroken. And then we have the scene later in the hotel room after this when she's drunk or high and he's dancing with her and she's going in and out of consciousness. And there's a shot of just her feet dragging on the floor.
Mm-hmm.
And she's helpless. And at this point, she's kind of realizing who she is and she can't get away from what she has become. I think groupie is probably echoing in her head at this point, and she's doubting everything now. And so I think, again, that's a big low, but she makes it come across so tenderly, and it hurts to see her in those moments.
Yeah. My favorite sad moment of hers, because I think it is like, I think it might be her best scene in the movie, or what I would pick for her Oscar scene, like we do on our Contenders episode, mm-hmm. when she says to William, "You don't know what he says to me in private. Maybe it is love." And he tells her about the bet and how he sold her for $50 and a case of beer. And you just see this look on her face and she just says, "What kind of beer?" It's so good. It's great writing, I think, of course. But the way she plays that scene is just right, because it is really sad, because you can see that understanding that she has and she starts to cry. But at the same time, I think it's, again, that performance of just kind of brushing it off. And that's also before we get, I think, more of her pain that we see later mm-hmm. with the Quaaludes in the hotel room and her at the diner, which I agree, those are also really good scenes for her.
Yeah. And I think Frances McDormand is also, and obviously, very good at subtlety. I love her moments throughout the film, her brashness as a mother in the beginning. But then there's a really subtle scene when she's on the phone and she's talking to one of the Band-Aids. I think it's Sapphire, played by Fairuza Balk.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, "Are you the one with the pot?" And she's, you just see her eyes on the other end of the phone go, "Oh my God, what have I done?" But whenever she talks to William, she still gives him the space to grow and live and not feel too bogged down. And I love seeing that part of her as a mother come out. And he can't hear her and she keeps saying, "I love you." And she just takes one final breath and like screams it a little bit into the phone, but "I miss you and I love you." And she's holding back tears and he hears her finally. And she's, you can just see what's going on in her head and how annoyed and, you know, everything she's feeling for her son. And he goes, "I love you," and cuts off. But Frances, she's so good.
I love her in everything, really. I just love her voice. It's probably a weird comment, but I just have always loved her voice. But what I also love about this character is she still lets him go, right? That's mm-hmm. the thing, is she's calling all the time. He always has these urgent messages at the hotel. She has so many great phone calls. She has another really good one with Russell later on that I love. But she still lets him go. She still lets a teenager spend his last year of high school on the road with this band. And he keeps saying, you know, "I'm going to come home. Next city, I'm going to come home. This is the last one." At any point, I mean, she is his mom. He's a minor. She could come get him and just be like, "This is mm-hmm. all over. You're staying at home. You're grounded." It is the 70s. It's a different time, I think. Different yeah. kind of parenting. But she lets him. She still lets him do this and knows deep down, I think, that this is important to him and that she needs to let him do this. And she knows who he is. So even though she wants him to be a lawyer, I think there's a part of her that just thinks it is a lost cause and I'm yeah. just going to let him go and spend this time with this band.
Yeah, when she does initially let him go, it's almost like we're watching Inside Out and they're like zooming into her brain and there are seven of her characters inside her head at the same time, and we're seeing her audibly go through deciding what to do. And she's like, no. Okay, if you go. And yeah, it's that hesitation and juggling so many things. Again, being a single mom, and should he go, should he not go? And that ties into him and his experiences and wanting to live. But you also realize that on this journey, as he's missing his last year at school, he's like, am I doing the right thing? What am I making my future? Is this the right decision for me?
Yeah.
Because when he's not there at his graduation and the principal or whoever it is calling his name saying not present, and his mom is still like, everyone clap for him, you know, even though he's not here, you feel that guilt or emptiness or question of, you know, what am I doing? Am I too young to realize this? Where will I be in 20 years? You know, as he's writing this Rolling Stone cover story at 15. Again, it doesn't spell it out too easily for you, but I love that. Again, the mom is feeling something that he's going through in his own way.
Yeah, and I also think with her character, like Anita says at the very beginning, you've robbed him of an adolescence. So it's almost like in letting him do this with the band, she's kind of just like fast-tracking adolescence here. She's like, I'm going to let you have this crash course, actually, of being a young person in the most extreme way possible. Another thing that I think is kind of a core part of this being a coming-of-age story and its connection to music, which I really think Cameron Crowe does so, so well in the screenplay, is when throughout the movie, William is chasing this sit-down with Russell. He's the one band member who he's spending a lot of time with and he's learning a lot about, but he wants to have that conversation with him. And he asks him, do you have to be in love to write a love song? Do you have to be sad to write a sad song? And I think that's such a good underrated line in the movie, because I think it taps into like to the truth of emotion in art and in what these characters are feeling. Because like we've said, sometimes we know how they feel, but they're not directly telling us how they feel. And then you wonder, you know, are they expressing it actually through their art? Are artists doing that with songs? Are filmmakers doing that with films? And do your feelings in your real life have to match what's coming through in your art? I don't know. It's just an interesting little nugget that he includes.
I think that shows us of this facade that he's created with this entire movie and of these characters that we're talking about, this mystery. And one of the later scenes, I think we have two big scenes to talk about. One is the almost plane crash, referencing Lynyrd Skynyrd, because in that moment, they are all potentially about to die and they start to confess to each other how they really feel, what really happened, who they really are. And this is the first time we really get to see William say how he feels about the band and what he's seen as an outsider and what we've seen, you know, getting to know a part of them on this tour. So I love that, you know, it totally shifts the movie. I would never have expected a potential plane crash. So it opens us up to finally them being honest with each other, for better or worse. And this is the moment that sparks him to finally have something to write about for this feature, William. And again, it's not all pleasant of them, but it shows us that, you know, all of the conflict they've had together throughout this movie, that there still can be catharsis in the end. And it's not all hatred or frustration or anger that we've seen a lot through Jeff and Russell in particular.
Yeah, I like that scene also for the relationship between Russell and Jeff. And I actually think Jason Lee, he also gives a really good performance in the movie as Jeff, because, you know, he's the lead singer in the band, yet Russell is the heartthrob. He's in the front on the band t-shirt that blurs them all out. He is the pseudo frontman in a way. And I think he does a really good job of showcasing that insecurity, his ego a bit, and just in what that looks like in his relationship with Russell. Because at first it starts out as just these small kind of self-deprecating jokes, and then it feels way more personal as the movie goes. So I agree. I really like that scene. Yes, a reference to Lynyrd Skynyrd. Also a reference, I think, to Buddy Holly, who died in a plane crash. So yeah, when that's happening too, I like how the scene, it starts out and Russell's like, if anything happens, I love you. And then it just devolves and they're really sharing mm-hmm. how they feel, like they need to get everything out in those final moments.
Yeah. And then after this, I love how randomly the sister is now a stewardess and sees William in the airport. She goes, you look awful, but you're living your life. Again, it's that same advice that she gave him in the beginning of the movie. And I think it's a great bookend to have her now see him after this journey he's gone on, and she doesn't know anything that's happened, but you can see it in his face how he's aged in a year. Then they go home, they meet the mom. I love their silent reunion on their porch. And then after this is when Russell calls Penny. She gives him her address, but then that ends up being William's address, because he says she wanted us to be together. Mm-hmm. She knows that their relationship is essentially more important in the long run between Russell and William than her and Russell, because of what has happened in New York. So it's just such a sweet ending. You know, he gets his interview finally, and you still get to see that energy of him really wanting to be a rock critic. He's so tired. He just wants to rest. But then Russell's there. He said, okay, let's do this one more time, and goes right into it. It's such a perfect ending to this movie. There's hope, there's closure, and it leaves you on a high of honoring this era that other movies I've seen also do so well. You mentioned PTA. I thought of his Boogie Nights throughout this movie, and then other great movies with amazing soundtracks like Dazed and Confused, also from this era, or even Say Anything with John mm-hmm. Cusack, and how music is so important and instrumental to characters and people's lives and journeys.
I completely agree. And I think, you know, at its core, what I love about the movie and the screenplay is that I think it is, for me at least, my favorite movie about unrequited love, which is a great topic. You can, you know, mine that to death. I think a lot of people have, authors, filmmakers, etc. But I think what this does that's different from other films is that it's not just about loving a person who can't love you back. It's about loving art and how that will never love you back. Or at least the love that art can give you is different, right? It's not the same type of love. It's not reciprocated in the way that you might expect. And I think for William in particular, his love of music feels big and overwhelming. And I think that's what's really exciting, is this idea of you're one person, and what musicians do when they create music is they conjure up some sort of magic that makes you fall in love in a different way, right, than when you fall in love with a person. But here, I think what Cameron Crowe does is he combines that idea. He shows Penny Lane's love of music and her love of Russell and how those are intertwined and connected. So I think it's just a really beautiful theme that they talk about mm-hmm. and how they involve art in that. And that the way that this movie feels really like putting on an album. You know, you have your favorite tracks, you have those moments that make you feel really alive. And I feel like they just do such a great job of making you understand why someone could be so obsessed with art that they want to talk about it forever, or they want to create it forever. I think that is the most beautiful thing about the movie. And I think now 25 years later, I think it's definitely inspired filmmakers today with coming of age stories and movies about this time period and music. And I know it will continue to also.
Oh, definitely. Again, I am surprised I hadn't seen this, but I'm glad I finally did. It'll definitely be a rewatch for me. What are some other favorite quotes that you had from the film?
I have so many, but I will try to be brief. I love when, well, one, I think it's all happening. It's iconic for this movie. If you are a fan of Vanderpump Rules, listeners, you will know that Sheena Shea got a tattoo of this because of this movie. I love when Penny Lane says, I always tell the girls, never take it seriously. If you never take it seriously, you never get hurt. If you never get hurt, you always have fun. And if you ever get lonely, just go to the record store and visit your friends. I love that. I think that's a great one. I also love all of the Zeppelin references. When Sapphire says, does anybody remember laughter? That's a reference to Robert Plant. If you like Led Zeppelin or if you're just curious about Zeppelin, I highly recommend the concert movie, The Song Remains the Same. It is a bizarre treat. You get to see them perform at Madison Square Garden, and each member has their own kind of fantastical interlude that they have. It's definitely a way to get to know more about the band members. And then the other is, you know, in the scene when Russell and William go to that party in Topeka, that random house party. First, I think it's so funny that they're there because that just could only happen in 1973. My thought when watching that was that could never happen today because of social media and cell phones. Yeah. Everyone would be recording. Everyone would, you know, tell Dumois or whoever that he was there. But he's able to just, you know, take acid and live his life with these strangers. But when he says, I am a golden god, that is a direct Robert Plant quote. So I really like that. I think Lester Bangs has a couple of really, really good ones too. But the big one, I think that's also kind of the thesis of the movie, is when he says, yeah, great art is about conflict and pain and guilt and longing and love disguised as sex and sex disguised as love. And let's face it, you got a big head start. So that, I think, also connects back to that idea of him, you know, having a real coming of age moment, growing up really quickly and just being, you know, immersed in that world and understanding even more about art and what they're creating and life, too.
Yeah. Another one I like towards the end of the movie, after they get the call from Rolling Stone to check William's story, is Jeff is screaming to the heavens, is it that hard to make us look cool? And he's also wearing a shirt of his own face and name, referencing the previous drama with their shirt and, yeah, Russell being on the front. But this is also a great way to end the movie of, you know, they create this art, they put their heart and soul into it. There's conflict along the way, but in the end, it all that matters is how you're seen in an article in a magazine that everyone is going to read and your fans will see. It's reductive, but it's true. And I think, you know, there's all this passion and love that you can put in to whatever you love or hobbies you have. And, you know, it's still about what others think of you and your following. And that speaks to social media. And it's sad, but it's the reality of any kind of art or medium.
Yeah. Well, and one that connects with that is when, I think it's a little line later when Jeff says, he's the enemy, although it would be cool to be on the cover.
Yeah, them calling him the enemy the whole time.
Yeah. One more really great one that's a Frances McDormand line, because I think she has so many really good ones. A lot of them we've said already, but I love when she's dropping him off at the concert. Not when she says, don't take drugs, even though that's very funny, and everyone starts mocking her, and she's like, oh God, I got to get out of here now. But when she says, look at this, an entire generation of Cinderellas, and there's no glass slipper.
Oh, Frances. Yeah, she's so good here. I'm glad they were both nominated.
Me too.
Speaking of the Oscars, I know you mentioned supporting actress before. I think if Kate would have won, like we talked about with Whoopi on our recent After Dark episode, that you said she's one of your favorites now. I think Kate would have been one of my favorites had she won. Is Marsha winning over our Almost Famous stars disappointing to you, or are you a pro Marsha win here?
I would have been pro Kate winning here. I really like her performance and think she would have been a perfect supporting actress winner. Nothing against Marcia Gay Harden at all, but Kate Hudson and Almost Famous, this is just one of those touchstone performances for me, I think, growing up that I just really loved. And I think even watching her in it now, it has lost none of its power. It's only really gotten richer over time. And as I've gotten older and feel like I can understand the character better. So yeah, I would have given it to Kate Hudson here for sure. The one thing I wanted to ask you about the Oscars is that this is somehow not nominated for Best Picture. And I definitely would have found room for it in the lineup because This is my favorite movie of 2000. I think if I'm just looking at the list, this is definitely my favorite. But I do really love Erin Brockovich. I love Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. This is, of course, the double Steven Soderbergh year with Traffic also, which I know was a huge deal. That one SAG ensemble, which I didn't know that, actually. I would have assumed that Almost Famous would have won. That feels like such a SAG ensemble type of win, but I had just totally forgotten about the success of Traffic and how much that was really beloved by the industry. And then Gladiator, obviously a huge, huge hit. And I think, you know, one of those Best Picture wins that when you're looking at the time and the year, totally makes sense. But I would have given it to Almost Famous.
I guess I would have taken out Chocolat for Almost Famous. Yeah, I definitely think it deserves a picture nomination and or a director nomination. This is a really great lineup. I know we talked about Gladiator before a little bit, but I'm glad it did get a win in writing. I think it really is a superb script. And then we briefly talked about editing in our review, but I would have loved to have seen editing too and or cinematography because of, again, the era and how it's filmed. It's very distinctly Cameron Crowe in the best way.
Yeah, I really like that editing nomination. I'm really glad that that happened. And I also really like the BAFTA nomination for Best Sound. I think that that's a really good inclusion. I also like that they have Best Film Music as a category because that feels like a great nomination for the movie too. But even though this didn't win many Oscars, it only won one, I do love its original screenplay win. I feel like that's perfect for it.
And it had the Grammy win too because of the soundtrack. So yeah, some great wins across the board. If you could give this movie one Oscar, what would it be?
That's so tricky because I am between two, but I think I'm going to just keep the Oscar that it has. I'm going to go with original screenplay because I love the way that the themes are explored. It's one of my favorite coming of age films, and I just think every character is so well written, and I like the turns that the movie takes. I think just the things that it explores in the life of musicians or this critic or Penny Lane in particular, I think that it does a really good job of balancing all of that. So I'm glad that Cameron Crowe won, and it's not just about dialogue, obviously, screenplay, but the quotes are just great too. Like, we have so many that we ran through, and I think that's really why this has stood the test of time. So I'm going to go with screenplay. What about you?
I'm going to go with screenplay too. I think Kate Hudson is a close second for me, but in how he crafted this story, again, it's somewhat autobiographical. It talks about the music industry, real bands, fictional bands. Stillwater was a real band, but the Stillwater of the movie was fictional. And I think how they incorporate all those elements with Rolling Stone and the characters, all the relationships we talked about, I think it's just phenomenal. And it's a movie that is so electric and exciting and conflicting at the same time. There's just so much conversation to be had, and I think he captures so much about humanity and the industry and art at the same time really, really well. So and like you said, the quotes are fantastic. Lots of great one-liners and conversation. So I think, again, a knockout script. So glad it won and that we got to talk about it today. 25 years. I don't know if that feels long or not now.
What is time?
It's a quarter of a century. I don't know. It will make us feel old before too long.
Yeah, I'm so glad that we got to talk about this movie and that it gave us an excuse to rewatch it. I love rewatching this movie, and I think it really was like the perfect opener for this season. I'm so glad that we got to talk about it. Next time on Oscar Wilde, we will be talking about 2025 movies. So I think we'll be sharing some of our favorite movies of the year so far, what we think are some of the best movies. We are past the first quarter of the year. We're heading into the summer. So before we get into some of those summer releases, I think it's always good to just do a little check-in and talk about some of the movies we like. I'll definitely be talking about Black Bag, the Steven Soderbergh movie. But there are a lot of fun ones I think we can bring up for this, good or bad.
It's been a rough year so far, I will say. I have some to catch up on. We also had Sinners out recently that we'll definitely talk about. Everyone is raving about that. So yeah, definitely some highs and lows. Thank you all for joining us back for our season 6 premiere. I'm excited for the year ahead. And feel free to rate, review, and follow us on Blue Sky, TikTok, Twitter, and Instagram at Oscar Wilde Pod. And bonus content, like I mentioned, our recent After Dark episode on Patreon about Demi Moore in Ghost and Isabella Rossellini in Blue Velvet. That's at patreon.com/Oscar Wilde.
Thanks, everyone. We'll see you next time.